This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Stop the cross!
No, run about two.
Oh, are you fucking kidding me? Has he really just done that?
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of myoldmansaid.com. And joining me from 8 minutes of madness at Villa Park, Dan Rogers from the villaunderground.com and Mr. Chris Budd from the Upper Holt.
Hello,
Society. Hello, you fine, beautiful people. We are the finest football team once again over the time period of 8 minutes. The other parts of the game, they don't matter.
Yeah, the symbolic.
It's not how
80...
you start, it's how you finish, isn't it?
That's the end of it.
Symbolic 82 minutes, which nods to our European glory.
It's like they knew.
It's like a mirror reflection now. It's just of just impotence.
Flaccid.
Flaccid for 82 minutes.
But that eight minutes, rock solid.
Pure penetration
of the Sheffield United backline. Well, we'll discuss this epic encounter and file it on the top shelf of bizarre Aston Villa draws for the season. There have been many of them.
I'm going to need a new shelf.
The shelf's breaking.
Dean Smith is the new Alex McLeish, but in a different way. Instead of nil-nil and one-all, it's 5-5s, 3-3s. Bedlam, last-minute bedlam. But we'll get into that game and also look back at the two decidingly average performances against Ipswich and Reading as well. We did actually record a Ipswich podcast, which we will chop sections out and feed them to the My Old Man Said patrons. Reading, we just couldn't pull ourselves off the floor of the ineptitude to record something. So we packaged it all together for you in this show. So we'll talk about Sheffield United in the context of those two games. We'll do a three. Actually, we'll use the 3 points from the Ipswich podcast, where we go from the sad to the hilarious. And we also have Where Were You When We Were Good, which looks back at a Reading game that took place when Mr. O'Neill was the manager.
In 2010.
Was it FA Cup sixth round?
FA Cup, yeah, on the way to, it got us to the Wembley semi-final, didn't it? Where we subsequently
Chelsea,
got spanked.
Another great comeback.
Ah, yes.
We were 2-0 down, and that time we did four. See, if we just started to kick on against Sheffield United when we were 2-0 down, we might have still have won this game, but hey-ho. First of all, just want to announce a competition where you can have a pleasure of going to Villa Park to see another high-scoring draw against Middlesbrough on the 16th of the 3rd. And we are serving you up two VIP seats in a box. You get food and drink thrown in. It's suggested you get there about one to two, so you can really tuck in and fill your boots.
They don't literally throw the food at you, by the way.
That's just a tip. Get there early, eat, drink a lot. But yeah, I can't even remember who's sponsoring this.
It's a competition and we're running it, so whatever.
It's a legit competition, by the way, and it's exclusive to My Old Man Said podcast listeners. Doesn't sound legit, does it? I'm just pretending to be a listener.
We might need to work on the branding for these prizes.
You get to watch Villa for 82 minutes and then you get to walk out in disgust.
So these two tickets, VIP tickets, food and drink, I think they're offered up by some betting company who I've stopped actually doing anything with betting companies and affiliate accounts. But the good news is here, we're not even going to mention them on this podcast. And also the other good news is you don't actually have to do anything. You don't have to sign up or follow them or anything like that. All you got to do is just enter by listening to this podcast. And all you have to do is send an email to contact@myoldmansaid.com with the answer to this question. At what minute in this episode of the podcast does the Super Jack theme tune appear? And any regular listener to the show will know exactly what we're talking about. If this is your first time and you have been tricked into listening to this podcast because you want to enter this competition, it's the Superman theme that kicks in every time Jack Grealish is first mentioned on the show. And if you are new to this show, keep on listening for the rest of your life. Thank you very much. And subscribe if you're on iTunes, subscribe if you're on Spotify or any podcast app that you use. So just to repeat, what minute does the Jack Grealish Super Jack theme tune kick in? As long as you get it in the minute, it doesn't matter about this what seconds it is. And email me on contact@myoldmansaid.com, subject Super Jack. And next week, well, the next show, we will announce the winner for two tickets to go to the Middlesbrough game on the 16th of the 3rd and get the VIP treatment. Good luck. Before we get into the show, please do become a patron and you will be privy to extra shows. First of all, there's weekly bonus shows. You might get a couple of other extras in the next week or so because we did have record a full podcast, which we will now mutilate and chop up and post it in smaller pieces. Go to myoldmansaid.com and click on the patron option and the whole on the menu bar and all the details and frequently asked questions, etc., are all there, or just email me if you have any further questions. So let's get into this. 3 points, first of all. Dan, do you want to take the first point?
Yeah, let's get the difficult one out of the way first, which is the tragedy. You can't really badge it as anything else of Cardiff, the new Cardiff City striker Emiliano Salah's awful, awful passing, it seems, in the English Channel, travelling between Nantes and Cardiff directly. You know, it's a rags-to-riches type tale, and he's a player that obviously Cardiff will never see grace their pitch.
If you're flying out, I think half seven at night in the summer, I think you'd get away with that one if you had a problem with the plane. But in that visibility, in the conditions, and exact, you know, where they were, it's kind of well known for shipwrecking, isn't it? So it was a bit of a no-hoper there.
Well, it's a bizarre one because it's not as though, I mean, I know there's from the articles I've read, and it's not a direct flight, but it's one of those where you could negotiate the journey via either high-speed train or, you know, an indirect flight the next day. So it seems bizarre they took the risk. I mean, whoever took that risk, I think it will come out to.
I mean, I was thinking about this the other day about isn't this kind of indicative of like modern football and all the money that's come in, where you're now chartering planes and you're, you know, using private helicopters, and obviously what happened at Leicester. And this, I mean, sadly, is a byproduct of the advancements in riches in the game. And, you know, because a lot of teams now are flying by planes, chartered planes to games, aren't they? Even within England.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so that risk element has kind of gone up now. In terms of the football context, I mean, the only thing from a Villa point of view that I could, you know, you can't get close to relating to it, but obviously Luke Nillis, his injury, where we signed a striker and we had high hopes for him because he was part of, you know, him and Van Nistelrooy back in the day at Feyenoord had, you know, scored ridiculous amounts of goals. And obviously he scored that great goal for Villa and then broke his leg and that was career over. But obviously there's a bit of a difference in terms of having your career over and obviously your life over.
I mean, there's so many angles to this that there are some unknowns, and I think that there's stuff ongoing. You know, let's not forget as well, there was obviously a pilot who lost his life as well. Aviation is so safe, but as you were just saying, that with the amount of money in the game, that private aviation is actually markedly more unsafe. And you wonder, is that because it's this immediacy, it's this sheer wealth of I must get from point A to B as quickly as humanly possible?
Yeah, you just got to think about how they, like, for example, on deadline day, where it's like this high adrenaline, get this player, at this time. And, you know, they're going to, you're getting into the realms of taking risks in terms of transport. Obviously, sad news for all Cardiff fans. Another loss of a different kind, Chris Budd.
Chris is still with us, by the way.
I am still in the game. This is the not really surprising news that Mr. Henry has lost his va-va-voom and been removed.
Dumped.
Yeah, he's been dumped and replaced by his predecessor, Jardin, at Monaco off the back of a 5-1 home defeat to Strasbourg. I think he's won two in, I think it's 17 games. And following that game, he'd called an opposition player's grandmother a whore, which didn't seem to go
down. Is that legit?
That is legit.
Is it?
And apparently his own players stormed into the boardroom and said, we can't have this. You know, told the boardroom to remove him. The next day he was suspended.
I remember when Villa were linked with Henry, I remember reading somewhere, I can't remember if it was a player or a journalist saying, he's crazy, don't get him.
I mean, it's fair to say we've dodged a bullet.
Just because he gets sacked and has a bad patch with a team that obviously, let's face it, didn't have a great squad, everybody turns against him and ridicules him. So you never know, you know, players... or managers, sorry, have a dodgy first innings at some club and then go on to be great managers. I mean, look at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and, you know, his time at Cardiff wasn't hardly celebrated, and it would never allude to what he's doing at Manchester United at the moment. Just one thing on this, the hilarity of him being replaced by the manager who left.
Being placed on gardening leave and by Mr. Garden. In English, is quite...
Yeah, Jardin. But there is a connection here, because you would have noticed that Steve Bruce started his job February the 1st. Now, under closer examination, the reason for this is, and it wasn't just because he wanted to go and see the cricket, it was basically a deal with the Villa board to say if Dean Smith doesn't beat Ipswich, then they'll sack Smith and Bruce will be back manager of Villa February the 1st.
He'll be dusting ourselves down.
So what you're saying is, let's just clarify here, if Tammy Abraham had missed that penalty and the Ipswich effort had not hit the post and gone in, Steve Bruce would have been back. Wow.
Yeah.
God damn it, Glenn Whelan.
There you go.
It was an outstanding performance from Whelan, once again influencing the direction of Aston Villa.
I think Christian Perslow, the Villa CEO, referred to it as the Monaco syndrome, where you sack a where you sack a manager and you get the old one back in. It's a new thing in modern football now, so watch out for that. Talking about a new thing in modern football, it's point number three is club owners going on Twitter. We've obviously experienced this from a Villa point of view, Dr. Tony.
Idiot.
And his emojis and all kinds of crazy stuff, but thank God he didn't commit this heinous crime, because this would have melted Villa Twitter right down to the bone.
It would have been our Chernobyl, wouldn't it, really?
And I'm referring to Notts County owner Alan Hardy, a.k.a. Big Al.
I mean, if Alan Hardy wasn't enough for you, Big Al, I want to be known as Big Al. Call me Big Al.
Posted a dick pic by mistake, or shall we say a picture of his penis, which he happened to have on his camera roll.
Don't you all?
Of course it was a simple mistake. I mean, this actually outdoes Julian Lescott, I think.
I'd say so.
On his Twitter, obviously a lot of fans saw this. Much embarrassment to him. He took it down straight away. He was doing a comparison tweet using a picture of... he was basically saying how football fans are so fickle. So the first...
Flaccid, he meant.
First screen grab was a fan wishing him Merry Christmas and all that kind of stuff. And then he was looking for the picture of screen grab of this fan, you know, obviously giving him shit, and instead put a picture of his cock up on
we've all been
on his
there.
Twitter. And the big thing that it revealed was that Big Al is not really Big Al.
Wasn't there someone who requested he change Twitter handle to Small Alan.
Yeah. Somebody, yeah. I thought the funniest comment was hung like a slug's eyebrow. Which I've never heard before.
I'll be using that.
But one of the unfortunate things about this mishap was in the same morning that he did this, he had also posted posted a picture celebrating the fact that he'd taken pride in forming a Notts County Girls Academy team, giving over 150 girls and women a football pathway every week. There were pictures of, like, I don't know, like 2 10-year-olds. So you're looking on his Twitter feed, you got a picture of 2 10-year-old girls, and then the next picture is a picture of his penis.
Oh, dear.
But poor old Al. It all it just blew up in his face.
Blew up in his face? Good grief.
He did refer to it amongst all the carnage this morning, and I think carnage is a pretty good word to describe it.
He'll be doing I'm a Celebrity by next year.
But the danger of owners, well, anybody really, manager and owner of a football club, you're walking a tightrope. There was also references to Caroline Radford, who's the CEO of Mansfield Town. And so when you look on her Twitter, she's married to the owner, so she's as good as the owner. There's a picture of her on a cruiser bike on the end of a jetty overlooking Blue Sea in the Algarve, with an old Nokia phone saying, maybe taking it back to basics, but still working on deals. Watch this space. Old school Nokia transfer window.
I mean, how did she take the Instagram photo? It wasn't on a Nokia.
No idea. Good point.
Mm-hmm.
And post it as well. And then there's another shot, and it's hashtag match day, hashtag good vibes, hashtag Mansfield Town FC. And it's entitled High Tides and Good Vibes. And there's a picture of her in a bikini.
You can't see much of the tide there.
And it's not like I'm just wearing a bikini. It's a suggestive posed shot as well. Preferable maybe to the dick pic. But it's just, you know, owners.
It's a long way from Keith Wynas as well. I mean, if I have to have a barometer of CEO.
But I'm just glad Christian Perslow is not on Twitter.
In a bikini. I mean, we will await the dick pic. Put it on the wish list. We can stick it on a T-shirt then.
Yeah, if I was them, I would stay off.
It's probably advisable, isn't it?
Regardless of being in a bikini doing a suggestive pose, but if you had a CEO in the Algarve on a match hashtag match day, that would throw up enough toxicity straight away.
Sure would.
I think that's the main gripe there. Is to be seen on holiday on a match day. I think at the moment Mansfield are in one of the automatic promotion spots.
That's weird because I saw a Villa player on holiday on a match day.
Oh, that was at Birmingham Airport, wasn't it?
It was, wasn't it?
Old Johnny Codge.
Hey, I won't have any ill will spoken about my good friend Jimmy Danger.
Right, anyway, let's get into the Villa business. Right, Sheffield United, going into the game, we just obviously played two of the bottom three teams, beat Ipswich 2-1. Not exactly convincing. We should have seen them off when we were 2-0 up. And then obviously the trip to Reading, where I think we hardly had a shot on target, did we? But anyway, I had reservations about Villa's chances, but I was just kind of hoping that previously they needed a more of a challenge to kind of, let's say, step up. And I was hoping Sheffield United would spark Villa into life. But the players were just, they played as if with the same intensity as they did against Ipswich and Reading. And it started off very flat until those last 8 minutes. What was you feeling, I don't know, when the second one went in and then obviously the third one? I'm surprised you stuck around until the end. Dan Rogers.
How was I feeling? It felt like deja vu, didn't it? You know, I'm happy for people to look back at the timeline on my on Twitter. It felt like as bad as it had been for a long time.
I called it a shambles. I mean,
well, over 80 minutes, I suppose, until as you say, we came to life. We were listless, and when we did try and get the ball forward, do you know, it was the comparison between us and Sheffield United. They seemed to break on us like so many teams do, so quickly, and it put us in. We seemed to be in absolute disarray at the back as well when the ball did get.
And notice when Villa attacked them, they had two midfielders entrenched right in front of their back four. and they were so tight. They shut down all the spaces. I mean, this is kind of rudimentary, well-organized lower league teams. You shut down all the spaces on the inside. You play two midfielders as close to your, you know, your centre backs. And Villa never committed anybody into the box with any conviction. So you're looking at that Villa attack transpire, and you've got like eight Sheffield United players in the penalty box, and like two Villa players floating around. And the odds are, you know, those Villa players aren't going to get the ball. Go to the other end, and Sheffield United, when they attack with a wave. They always had four or five players, and there'd be two or three at least always arriving in the box against the same amount of Villa defenders, because our midfielders weren't getting back with any urgency. So it was pretty obvious how the game was going to pan out, you know, from an early, you know, from the first 20 minutes or so. Well, I'm saying until the madness at the end kicked in. But that came out, and that point came out of nothing, did it?
Yeah, they were robbed, let's be honest. Villa didn't deserve. I mean, you could argue Sheffield United couldn't defend, as most teams in this division can't. But for the majority of that game, Villa were second best. It was almost like watching us the year we went down. It was that clueless. A few of the guys who sit by me were saying the same, that, you know, you never mind getting played off the park by a far superior side. Yeah. Sheffield United played well, but I wouldn't have said there was any standout players in their team. Obviously, Sharp got the goals, but there was no standout star where you thought, he's running the game. They're just a really well-oiled unit.
Apart from Sharp, I don't think many Villa fans would name any of their players that they would say, we wouldn't mind them in our team.
Yeah. They were just really workmanlike.
It was a different feeling to when Leeds were there, wasn't it? Where you're looking at some of their players and you thought, well, he's, as you say, Chris, the standout player.
Yeah.
But I just can't think of a game where, to touch on the points you've both made, where not only did it come out of nothing, I'm struggling to recall in games I've physically been at such a collapse from such a position of absolute security.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't just fall apart. They got the entire game turned on its head, and that's why the 82 minutes that came before it almost defy belief, because we were so bad. I'm struggling to find adjectives, actually.
Sheffield United, there was a couple of times when they had it wide when they were 3-0 up, obviously 8 minutes to go, and they could have, you know, killed the game and done the game management. And I think there's one time where the guy was going to go for it. He had nobody around him, but he's, you know, I think they thought Villa had been so abject that, you know, they might as well carry on and see if they can get four or five and, you know, put us to the sword, because we really had offered nothing. And, you know, people are saying great spirit. I don't think there is that great spirit. I just think we got lucky with the first one because their keeper made a howler. And it just seemed every time we got it in the box, they kind of boo-booed it up.
I mean, their goalkeeper ultimately had a mare. You know, he had very little to do all game. And he's somehow walking off the field, having picked the ball out of his net three times. You know, if I was a travelling Sheffield United fan, you'd be absolutely raging at them. You know, I mean, the last goal, you put it in the stand, and you either take a touch and you smash it out, and it's game over.
Yeah, I think there was obviously more spirit in, say, the Forest game when we're 2-0 down early doors, and then it's basically two teams going toe to toe, and, you know, both teams show a lot of spirit.
Yeah, we showed a lot more quality, didn't we?
This game, I think we got lucky a lot of the time, and it's kind of alarming. You just hope that the way the game panned out, it actually sparks a few people into life, because the last, you know...
We were unlucky in moments, though, too. I think that I do agree with what you say there, but their second goal should never have stood.
Well, I mean, I was talking before we switched on with Chris about this, and it's one of those where if you've got VAR, then the goal doesn't happen. But because that ball was... It was like a split second. Is it in his hands? Does he have control of that ball? You can't even tell on the replay. But if you had VAR, you kind of give it the benefit of the doubt. But it's such a 50-50 one where you kind of excuse it whichever way it goes.
Yeah, I think in a live,
in a live situation where they don't have the benefit of video replay, it's you know, one of the most 50-50 ones you can have.
As I said to you earlier, I think it's one of those goals, and from start to finish, you know, the whole goal came from us going from one end of the field, Codger throwing himself to the floor. Yeah. Some people said it was a penalty. I didn't think it was. And then we were just sloppy.
I thought the McGinn foul was a penalty. I don't know.
Yeah, and apparently
Mings was definitely that was a proper tug, and it was right in front of the referee, and those have been given all day long.
Did we get the breaks? I think what you saw with Villa in that game was they came out in the second half and they started okay, but then the second goal, you could just see the confidence just drain out of the team. As soon as they got the second, it was game over. You just thought, oh wow, we've tried to get up ahead of steam. and we've given away another stupid goal. Because regardless of, you know, whether there's an offside decision or whether the ball's in the goalkeeper's hands, Villa haven't reacted to that goal at all. I mean, the whole, you know, the cross coming in is dreadful. And the third goal is an appalling goal to concede. So yet again, Villa have scored three goals at home and conceded three. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just dreadful. You know, the more they look at them on the training ground, they'll be just head in hands, which is unfortunate because actually I thought the two centre-backs actually played quite well. I thought Mings actually had a really good game and he looked really assured in possession. But unfortunately, the two full-backs gave him no protection, and the midfield three were absolutely
and Mings had a good game against Reading as well. I mean, some of his long balls were actually, I mean, he sprayed one from left to right.
He's very assured.
Yeah, one from left to right, and it was you know, he dropped it on a pinhead. It was a fantastic ball. And we'll just cover off quickly the stamp from that Reading game. Well, since we've mentioned Mings, I mean, the only thing, it's the same. It's a bit like that goal, that their second goal. It's one of those where there's just no conclusive proof either way that you can't, you know, you can't put £1 million on it and say that is definitely what happened there. When people are saying, oh, was there intent or not? I mean, when I watched the game, I think none of the players reacted or anything. Well, you know, when something's intended, it kicks off straight away and you know it's somebody stamped on somebody's head or there's some malicious intent, should I say. But the first time that I was triggered, something was happening just when the player was, you know, stood up and he had all blood coming down his face. And it was only when the video broke on Twitter that it all kind of kicked off.
As always, it's, you know, these super slow-mo videos all make everything look bad in every sport. Mm. I think everyone would agree was the whole, that passage of play was just, you know, he's a big lad and it was just very clumsy. Unfortunately, though, when you've got a 6'4",
6'5", you know, I think,
unit of a guy, 6'5" unit of a guy falling on top of you, it's going to hurt wherever you get landed on it. Just, and you know, the guy's actually very lucky that it wasn't
gangly
in his eye.
Legs as well. I mean, I suffer from the same thing, but I think I've got a bit more poise than Mr. Mings. The only thing I didn't like about the whole thing was just some Villa fans actually trying to prove that Mings had intent and whining. He said, oh, how can that not be intent, and putting up stills of Mings looking at the guy's head, which, I'm sorry, but when you put your foot down, you normally put your head down where the foot's going, and you can take a freeze frame on anything, can
were
say,
the
look,
same
this
people
proves
who were,
it.
Calling for Smith's head?
No, not necessarily. It's...
I'm booing Glenn Whelan.
You know, it's virtue signalling or whatever.
And that's where it gets lost, isn't it? You open something out to the social media sphere, and I'm afraid everyone becomes a forensic analyst of body language.
Yeah.
And
they want to get a reaction.
Well, and the thing is, you watch it in live time, like you said, David, and it's one of those that you could easily have missed it. And I think that it loses the narrative, not just in social media, but also in, I understand the guy's got a bad injury, but the pathetic Instagram posts from him and his girlfriend, like he's been some sort of victim. Yeah. You know, he's sustained an injury.
Well,
I feel very dreadfully sorry for him from that. But as you said, it's inconclusive. Did he have intent? I think there's enough reasonable doubt to say that it was clumsy. Yeah. Did he mean to do that to him? No, I don't see that at all.
No, and when it's the same, you know, the same frame of mind of Villa. This is what's worrying. You know, Villa fans, like when Tammy Abraham was rumoured to be going to Wolves, it's like, oh, yeah, he owes us nothing. Mm. He should go to Wolves. Yeah, good luck to him. He should be playing Premier League football. Jack Grealish going to Spurs, oh, he owes us nothing, you know, he should go to better himself. It's like, who the fuck do you support? Because you should be supporting Aston Villa
fight for your club.
The best for that. If Mings is 50-50 in terms of intent, why are you waving a big flag and go, look at this, his intent, you should ban him. You know, what's the thought process here? If he did intent, if he just walked up to him and stamped on his head, then you go, get that prick out of our club, fair enough. But when there's no solid evidence of intent, why are you screaming for his head? It doesn't make any sense. Why are you wishing that Jack Grealish moves away? Why are you wishing that Tammy Abraham, you know, patting him on the back and saying, good luck at Wolves? Liverpool, Luis Suarez, he's biting people, he's being called racist, you know, and they defended him to the death against any other fans.
They were entrepreneurial, they did t-shirts,
they celebrated it.
Anything, he was the victim.
And then he fucked off.
we would love to do Mings the Merciless t-shirts with a picture of him stamping on his head, but that would be in bad taste. But there's this weird mentality. I don't think you get promoted if you've got such a flaky flaky fan base. And I mean, I'll say that straight off. We've got to be pulling in one direction altogether. And if somebody isn't guilty, you don't try to make him out to be guilty if he's on your own bloody team. I wouldn't want these people in the trenches with me in the Third World War when it comes around.
And it's on the way.
It's on its way. Yeah. Right. Anyway, that's enough of the the stamping incident.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
So I think Mings could be one of the best transfers in terms of this season. I mean, long term, who knows? But so far, so good with Mr. Mings and Elphick as well. I mean, I was told going back to January that Chester potentially was going to have a proper operation and he'd be out for the season. Potentially. And so that's why he's been playing, you know, because we had actually no centre backs and obviously Tu Nzebe went, we didn't actually have the cover. So they kind of, I think they tossed the coin and decided that he should play on through injury. And Elphick's not coming back unless he knows he's going to be playing. So you can, you know, imagine with that in context, they're saying to Elphick, look, we're going to get some left footers in. You're going to play on the right hand side once we get them in. And if Elphick's thinking it's 50-50 that he'll be getting games, I don't think he'd come back from Hull. I think he would fight that decision. I wouldn't expect Chester to be rushed back anytime soon. It's a bit like the Grealish one, where they don't really tell you, he might be back next week. You know, 2 months later, he's still out. So I don't think we'll see a lot of Chester. What do you got to say about that?
The interesting one, actually, I was thinking walking out the ground, was they may never actually get to play together, but the prospect of Tyrone Mings, who is strong and athletic and can actually play football, and Tu Nzebe as a partnership.
Ooh,
yeah.
If you've got them together and a full pre-season, they could be a force.
Yeah, unfortunately,
I don't think it's
both of them aren't our players, so that's a bit of a problem.
No.
Which is a shame, actually, because you could see someone like Mings building himself up to be a bit of a captain.
I'm happy with Elphick and Mings. If that was now our solution to our defence going forward, and we were playing the way we were playing when Dean Smith first took over, but it's now the rest of the team that's all over the shop. It doesn't have a intensity, it doesn't have a kind of a consistent pattern, it doesn't seem to know what it's doing. I mean, we were kind of lucky, let's say, against Sheffield United. We were toothless against Reading, and against Ipswich, that game shouldn't have gone down to the wire. It should have been out of sight early doors.
No, Ipswich were woeful, weren't they, to be fair?
And don't we see him incredibly unbalanced in the middle of the pitch? And I think he's found himself with this, in part, inherited very unbalanced Villa team. I think we've already mentioned how the fullbacks, I think, you know, if you genuinely had the opportunity to bring in two more, you would. Yeah, permanent players. But the middle feels, it doesn't feel natural, like against Sheffield United. Jedinak had one of the worst individual performances in a Villa shirt that I can remember, you know, and it shackles other players. Players like Hourihane are impacted as a result. McGinn, as we've said many times, can't do the job of three and four players. And, you know, even when you swap, it was interesting to see the change in how Villa's style when Whelan came on and actually started spreading the ball around. The game turned on its head. It was a bit odd, really.
He gave us some control, and it's, you know, we've been using this word know, for week, every time we've been on the podcast, that Villa want to play a controlled possession game, but that you haven't seen them do it for weeks.
No, no.
And we seem incapable of doing it.
Do you think as well, and it's something that, because I don't think El Ghazi came into the game at Sheffield United until quite late on, really. I think he struggled to see the ball, he overhit passes.
Similar to his, like, the previous games against Reading, where he's kind of ineffective. He gets the ball and there's expectation, but then, you know, he doesn't, he either runs into traffic or he just makes the wrong decision. Horahan, I've been watching, and off the ball, I don't rate him at all.
No.
And he ball watches, he kind of follows the ball, and that's why there's, you know, midfielders running in behind him, because he's not actually tracking him, or, you know, basically saying that's my man if he's coming anywhere near the 18 yard box. And some of his passing today was a bit wayward. I mean,
I think he had a bad game, but as per usual, he got his usual assist with the corner.
Yeah, I mean, overall, his completion rate was at 88.7. Only Whelan topped him, and obviously Whelan was only on for 25 minutes. Jedinak's was way down at 63.4.
It was laughably bad, wasn't it?
And, you know, he was the first goal, I think he was all over the shop as well. And, you know, on that delivery, you know, for defending set pieces, was normally the kind of mainstay of Jedinak's game, why Bruce favoured him so much. And you know, statistically, he was always way, way, way ahead in aerials. One, I think, is the statistic.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have thought, because of the way, I mean, Whelan played reasonably well at Reading.
Yeah, he had a good game against Reading, I thought.
And so you kind of think, well, Jedinak must have come in for something tactically, and he didn't really look great under the high ball, which he normally does. He was a liability in possession, and because of the, you know, Sheffield United's movement was really good. They had a plan, and they stuck to it both defensively and attacking wise. And he just got run.
Because I mean,
over.
They attack with enthusiasm, don't they? And Jedinak just didn't have the sparkle to keep up with it.
No. And we got into positions down the right hand side. You know, we managed to at times pin Ender Stevens back, who I thought had a reasonable game for them. And but the amount of times we got into positions, and you just thought, you know, when Codger did it, he was guilty of it on a number of occasions. El Ghazi was as well, and Hutton is never really known for it. But we didn't just get our head down, get to the byline and cross it, which is one thing. While he had a bad run over Christmas, at least with someone like El Mohammadi, he'll get it out of his feet and he'll just deliver. Yeah. It's a very simple player. And, you know, someone like Abraham thrives on that. You know, it's no coincidence that when we actually got the ball into their penalty area, we actually caused them problems.
Yeah, I don't think Abraham's been seeing enough in terms of opportunities in the last few games.
I mean, he had one sort of meaningful touch of the ball in the game, in the Sheffield United game, and scored. He had a very, very quiet game, but, you know, he's obviously got his record, and it's the 20 goal target has now been broken. And
I think he's going to need 40 to get us promoted, because the amount of goals we concede and the fact that we're going to have to win a hell of a lot of games. They're obviously looking at the long game now for Smith, because I can't see promotion. I mean, just the performances of those last two games against Reading and Ipswich. I mean, they got 4 points, should have been six. They got 4 points, and people are going, oh, 4 points off the playoffs. But, you know, other teams have got a game in hand, and there's a lot of teams.
And we've got to play all of the top, you know, the top six have all got to come to Villa Park, haven't they?
The way we perform for those 82 minutes, you just know that against bigger, you know, better teams like Sheffield United, I mean, we were lucky to get away with a point there. The next six games, four of them are away. And, you know, we're talking Brentford, where we normally get smashed.
Stoke,
Blues. We haven't beaten the Blues for a couple of years, at least. We haven't beaten them at St Andrews since we've been in the Championship, have we?
No.
And we've got Forest as well. That could go any which way. And then the two home games, the tough ones against West Brom and Derby. You know, two teams, especially Derby, will be looking for a bit of revenge. So you're telling me we'd probably need to win four of those six to be in it. And have we suggested that we're going to win four of six games? I can't see it.
No, I mean, we mentioned earlier, we're looking at a position where we have to go on a run against the big teams. Yet, as I said to you, the stat earlier, against the bottom 10 sides, we've taken 19 points from a possible 42.
Yeah, and that's why we're not getting promoted.
I mean, that's relegation form.
The thing is, you look at that run of fixtures, we're almost, in the run-up to December, we were looking at that group of fixtures saying, oh, this is going to be our test. And this is almost the second test as to whether... It's actually a harder test, because I think that we need to win enough games in amongst that group of fixtures that you mentioned. And obviously, we've got the benefit of looking a little bit further forward in the fixture list here to stop this season drifting into something genuinely anonymous if we don't galvanize ourselves and have a bit of fight. And that's why, you know, the last 10-15 minutes to drag ourselves to a draw at Sheffield United. So
that is our last.
So strange, really.
But it's our last chance of a spark now. I mean,
it is. And, you know, this isn't just about consolidating a position. We've actually got to make up ground on teams.
Yeah.
Like you say, there's some with, and that's the big thing, that you're not going to achieve that by going win, draw, draw, loss here and there, you know, scraping another draw. You've got to go on long, sustained, not just unbeaten, but winning runs. And if they do that, well, look, you've just reeled off a group of teams that represent, you know, then they're not games that we've been winning anyway. And we've struggled against teams, or we simply haven't taken points off the teams that are clinging on to this division. You know, look back to Wigan. Wigan were a team who could beat no one, could score against no one. And that was an abject, absolute disaster. And
because as a football fan, you always have this innate optimism that your team can make it if we get a run together. But when you just, in the cold light of day, lay the evidence out of this season, and Wigan is a massive example, as is, you know, the last 11 games, and just the performance levels of the last three to bring it up to date to this podcast, even with rose-tinted spectacles, only a fool will believe that playing like that's going to get you anywhere.
I mean, I haven't been particularly impressed with the way we've played since the first half against Leeds. And even then, we didn't actually play particularly well. We were just very clinical.
Yeah, if somebody says, if you watched that game but didn't actually see the goals, and somebody said Leeds are 2-0 up, you go, yeah, they probably deserve that at half-time.
Yeah.
But we had the chances to make it 3, and that was the thing. Sometimes you don't have to play, you know, perfect to win a game. The fact that we were 2-0 up against Leeds, and that was the first time we've said it before, but that was when you knew we weren't going to get automatic promotion straight away.
Yeah.
And it seemed to suggest that we weren't going to get promotion full stop. I just want to move on to talk about, in the context of the rest of the season, the transfer window and how we look now as opposed to before January the 1st. If you line it up and look at the actual transfers, I think we've lost a bit of sparkle on paper, at least, when you're losing like Hogan and Bellassi, and who we replaced them with in terms of weapons going forward. There's just Carroll, really, and he's been out since September, October,
and he's injured again.
Well, every time we signed a player this window, and you just had a look, you know, what's been happening in his career, most of them have been out for a season or have had a chronic injury. Yeah. There was a theme, so that goes with Mings, Courtney House as well. Obviously, Tom Carell's obviously been a bit more recent in terms of his injury. You know, I would like to say, well, this window's one for the future, but it isn't, because most of them were loans anyway. Mm-hmm. And only really Frederick Gilbert is the only one that has any forward planning about it. So it's going to be really starting from scratch, but actually not having bought in players with an eye for the future. It literally is to the drawing board.
Someone replied to, I did a piece after the Reading draw around how, and it sort of picked up on some of the themes of what we're talking about now with the transfer window, that I'd said that Villa looked like a team in transition, and someone wrote to me to say that it's actually worse than that, but for the reasons that you've been saying, because it's not like we own many of these players. These players are probably going regardless of whether we somehow fathom a promotion or whether we stay in the division. And so what we've got is it's a bigger problem than transition, because those people are, you can already disregard them. You know, you're in this constant churn. The only thing I would say about the transfer window overall is, beyond what we're mentioning about loans, is that it felt like we were perhaps getting knocked back behind the scenes. I just wonder whether we had lots and lots of feelers out, and I, you know, there's a little bit of duplication with the Courtney House and Mings thing, and you wonder, well, was that just that those sort of, did they come up together? Were they not expecting to get one or the other?
Yeah.
Tom Carroll from Swansea seems like a very much a last minute.
Well, he said,
Who else have you got? type of question.
Yeah, but he did say in his interview, I mean, obviously, people say things just to appease the fans, or they're actually told to say things to appease the fans. And, you know, they made a point that this conversation had been 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're very naive, not you, sorry, but just generally, anybody would suggest that Tom Carroll would, Villa suddenly thought, oh shit, there's an hour to go. Oh, what about Tom Carroll? Quick, give him a ring. They scout players over weeks and months and take a look at him, and obviously have a list, and they go through the list. Obviously, there's preferences. So obviously they got down to Tom Carroll, And I would say that it was actually they finally triggered it at the end because, you know, X, Y, and Z didn't come through because obviously Tom Carroll's been out. And that was one of the things that we needed players for the now to basically shake us by the scruff of the neck and get us back for one last ditch effort at the playoffs. And we've seemed to have got players that they needed matches just to get match fit. And really, we're not in that position. We need straight out of the box players. And you just look at what we got, you know, Courtney House, Tyron Mings actually is, you know, he's playing well and contributing. Tom Carroll, as you said, got injured straight away. Frederick Gilbert just said, I can't bear it now. Can you give me a few months and just to get mentally adjusted to the fact that I have to play for Villa?
He'd rather be in a relegation battle in France.
Yeah. I think this relegation battle in France would give me enough the character I need to survive at Villa Park.
Always stitching him up, going, no, it's all right, you'll be fine with Alan Hutton.
But just just one quick thing, like the Mings, is it the Mings where we have this option to match the best bid of anybody?
Yeah, that's great.
My mind is Tyron Mings, if he super impresses for Villa don't get promoted, and any, you know, let's say of the lower half and the promoted teams from the Championship in the Premier League decides, we'd like Mings, he's going to go there because they just outbid Villa.
Yeah.
Of course they will.
So that's as simple as that. So, you know, they're slapping their, you know, high five and saying we've got this kind of option to buy thing, which I think that's what it is. It's just that if they got promoted and he played really well, then they'd have a chance, obviously, because they'll have the money to bid. And he would be in a mind to stay with Villa if he's had a good time and obviously contributed. But if he hasn't, if he's played well and we haven't gone up, then obviously he's going to be looking, sniffing upwards rather than in the quicksand of the Championship.
Well, he might be, but to be honest, from the way his career's gone with Bournemouth, I don't think he'd get a move in the Premier League.
Yeah, but he's now got a shop window, hasn't he, essentially?
Oh, what do you mean? So that if he plays, say, the next 20, 25 games and doesn't break down and...
Yeah, and he plays really well, he might get... He's going to resurrect his chances of getting back in the Premier League.
It becomes appealing to a team that maybe gets promoted or is scrabbling around the bottom, doesn't it? Because he'd be relatively inexpensive in the grand scheme of things, you'd have thought. I stand by what I said before that, you know, I don't think with loan players that we can even... I'd have been sad to have seen Abraham go, but, you know, I wouldn't have been crying into my pillow at night. Footballers are transient and largely mercenary anyway. But
we haven't got, like, for example, Fulham got the... They started to get their shit together at the back end of the year, and then in January they got Mitrovic, who was the missing link.
Mm. Do you not think the difference between us and Fulham at this time last year is I think that Fulham started slowly, but they were already on a trajectory, weren't they? And like you say, they were putting the final pieces in the jigsaw puzzle. We arrived into January having already gone out and sealed a goalkeeper because it was such a desperate need for one. That was a good news move, and I think he's starting to settle in. I think that our main bit of business was actually perhaps keeping hold of Abraham and rearranging our defence, the recall.
Just to reframe that, what I'm saying is Fulham got a signing that kicked them on more to get them over the line in the for the players, where there's no impetus. You know, we haven't got somebody in that's like changed the way we look at the situation of the rest of the season. We're just kind of
like that Mitrovic type figure.
Yeah, exactly. We've lost the potential spark of Bolasie, who I think we even said on this podcast that he would, if he got his act together, he would feature the second half of the season, would be where he would come into play.
Yeah.
And obviously he's disappeared and we've been denied that. That, at the time when we discuss it, was one of the reasons why we still thought we would, and we're going back now to, like, say November time, be a real deal in the final furlong, because we would have Bolasie having had 20 odd games under his belt and actually getting back to his best that made him a 20 plus million player. That's gone. We don't have that squad depth up front of Scott Hogan, and again you're hoping that he would find some form and kick in. Say for example, if Abraham got injured, we'd be I wouldn't fancy our chances of, you know, finishing above mid-table with if he disappeared.
I think that's a good bit of business, shifting Hogan on. I think that's a nothing lost there for us in the sense that, like you say, even if Abraham were to get injured and you slotted Hogan in, he's not suddenly going to become a 25 goal.
But so what about the is Chris Budd still there?
I am
what do
still
you think
here.
About the the argument, and I think it is a valid argument, about giving one of our strikers to, I would say, promotion rival, but maybe that's what...
Oh, you do read my website, David.
Sorry?
You do read my articles occasionally.
Though. No. This is just general common sense.
It's not general. It's
on
me.
On Twitter.
Me.
But giving Hogan to a rival, like, well, it's, you know, generally, do you loan players in the same division to one of your rivals? I mean, we're obviously getting ahead of ourselves here and saying we're actually a rival for promotion, which that's probably...
Well, we have, essentially, we
that's
have
probably why we let him go, because Dean Smith's probably thinking, what do you mean Sheffield United are rivals? When, you know, I've never finished higher than ninth. What are you talking about?
Yeah, we're not chasing down Sheffield United in third. I think if we're, the only position we're aiming for is maybe sneaking into sixth. That's the best we can do.
It's going to take a fucking miracle when you look at the fixture list. Not to piss on anybody's parades.
In terms of Hogan, I'm completely neutral about it. I just think, do you know what? He needed game time, as so many other players did. The frustrating thing, as you said earlier, was the fact that we're giving players who also needed game time have come in who are meant to improve us. And that's a little bit, people like Courtney Houser, for example, you just think when you've brought Mings in, you think, well, where's he going to fit in? You know, is he going to be a left back? I don't quite see.
I'll tell you what we have done, though. We've shifted so many of those, youthful fringe players out on loan.
Which was the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I think that.
Especially for next season, because they might be called upon, you know, the sort of your Dawe Hayes's, O'Hare's. Yeah.
You know, instead of them rotting in the under 23s, I just.
I was actually quite surprised that Hogan didn't stay and Keenan Davis didn't go and get games.
On the subject of Hogan, the narrative was, he's Dean Smith's former player. He's going to get the best out of Scott Hogan. The way it played out, obviously, that hasn't really materialised. And in the same breath, you could say, well, he's sent him to Sheffield United because he's got nothing to worry about. He's not worried about Hogan playing for somebody else.
I don't think there's no guarantee that Hogan's going to play there. I mean, you look at Billy Sharp, he's a goal machine, and you look at David
McGoldrick, he hasn't
scored goals. You don't. There's no guarantees Hogan's going to get anywhere near that starting
lineup.
The
Scott Hogan touch count for last week was zero because he didn't come off the bench.
And I think he's probably going to have to get used to that role. He's going to have to bide his time.
So I think,
and stay fit. You know, his fitness record speaks for itself.
Probably in terms of game time, we'll probably get the same amount. As if he stayed at Villa, potentially.
I'd agree with that.
So transfer window, it's an odd one because it was all a bit late, but the purpose of it hasn't, there's a few players there that obviously they're having a look at, but there's a lot, as we've said, players that aren't fit to hit the ground running out straight out of the box, players that are going to help us in the promotion run. It's kind of a weird one. We are definitely turning into like some kind of rehabilitation centre.
The new Lillishall.
Yeah, exactly. Or the Priory. To a certain extent, he's kind of recalibrated the squad in terms of balance. You know, I would push that one forward because at least with Mings and House, you've got a bit more presence on the left of the defence.
You've got more like for like, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, if anything happens to Taylor, at least you can put Mings out there. I mean, a lot of people were speculating that he was going to be left back, but I think the reason why he transitioned into a centre back after Ipswich was you don't get that many 6'5" left back bombing down the line.
No, I was about to say he plays well, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's some fantastic distribution.
Well, I'd definitely venture he's better as a fullback than Carlos Cuellar or Olaf Melberg, for example.
Quite possibly. One thing I'd say from the transfer window is ultimately we've been trying. I don't think Villa, or indeed any team in that division, none of them are in a position to go out and replace like for like a player like a Grealish. Mm. You can't do it, unfortunately. You know, you're not going to go and buy a £25 million midfielder.
You mentioned Grealish for the first time. Sorry, I've almost forgot there's a competition.
Listen to the whole
in
show now.
In terms of Grealish, at the moment, who's going to trigger that supposed release clause of £40 million? Nobody, I would venture.
I don't see it. I don't see that.
He would probably put in a transfer request at the end of the season if we're not going up. But it's not going to be a £40 million job. There'll be teams haggling over it. When Dean Smith says, the best player in the Championship, I'm like, well, he hasn't proved it.
On his day.
On his day in like 5 minutes, but he hasn't backed it up with the stats.
No, if I was a Premier League supporter of the calibre of the clubs that he's being touted at, first thing you'd say, well, is he consistent this season? Not compared to the second half of last season. And the most important thing is, for a £40 million supposedly asset that you're going to buy. I think for his age, he's yet to play a whole season. Mm. He still hasn't actually managed to get through a whole season without breaking down. You know, in the last two seasons, he's had two serious injuries.
Because, you know, he's only had 2 goals, 4 assists, is that correct?
Something like that.
Which, considering he's meant to be the best player in the Championship and he's playing essentially as an attacking midfielder with a license to get forward, is pretty crummy.
I mean, like last season, he's going to have to end the season fantastically, but there's no guarantee he'll just hit the ground running.
Yeah, and, you know, Villa weren't exactly unbeatable when he was in the team.
No, same as Twanzabi as well.
I don't think it would have changed that much because just the intensity of the players at the moment it's lackluster.
The big one for me, the Sheffield United game, unfortunately showed that, quality aside, Sheffield United wanted it more. They ran harder, they fought more, they tackled harder. They saw that game as a huge opportunity, and they'll class it as a big opportunity missed. But they wanted it way more than Villa, and you could tell that.
Teams are turning up to Villa Park knowing that...
Well, they know we're a sitting duck, and, you know, 3-0 down, it was. I'm sure it's the same for Dan in the lower hole, but up by me in the upper, it was absolutely toxic.
Everybody went home from the lower hole, I can tell you.
And everyone in the upper was fighting amongst themselves.
Yeah.
Again, it's like Wembley all over again.
There was a lot of Sheffield, well, I say a lot, there was a few Sheffield United fans in the lower halt as well who were ejected. Yeah, there's 5 or 6 pockets.
I saw that in the first half.
Normally the stewards can throw them out, but he required the police a few times.
Because there was a few, let's say, pockets of empty seats, you know, dotted around the lower Holt, the Trinity as well.
Yeah. There's all the huge sways of the upper Trinity was
away. Yeah, I think the kids for the quid certainly didn't work.
Although it is on a school night, so to speak. We'll wrap this up because we're going to go into the previously recorded Where Were You When We Were Good, which features, as we said at the top of the show, the FA Cup game against Reading under O'Neill when we were 2-0 down and turned it around to win 4-2, including a John Carew hat-trick. But just before we go into that, I can't take any more this under the lights. Come and see Villa under the lights. There's no better thing. It's like, is this how low we've come? We are now celebrating we have electricity or something.
Listen, it's kind of like, think of it like this. It's we're under the lights of like a Toby Carvery buffet, aren't we, really? That it's just sort of, you know, it's going to be disappointing, but you keep coming back.
It's slowly going off.
It's slowly
off.
Congealing.
Because
but it's a weird...
It's not exactly like a sunset over like Sydney Harbour, is it? Let's go. It's not an Ibiza
sunset. I've
said
this previously, you know, when the club are advertising as, you know, this is their hook to get you in, this romanticism of under the lights. This all came from European nights. And I'm sorry, but there's a big word missing. Well, two words, European nights is missing from under the lights. There's nothing like European nights at Villa Park. And they're like, oh, we don't get them anymore. What can we replace those two words with? Under the lights.
And the recent ones we did have were bloody awful anyway.
Oh, dear.
Oh. I remember those Europa League games. The ground was half empty and the games
I think
were all
this,
dreadful.
Hang on a minute. We're using words like dreadful and stuff like that. I think it's now time to segue into Where Were You When We Were Good.
Howard's corner. Mills is up from the back. Oh, and it's there. It's Shane Long. The man who got the winner at Anfield against Liverpool in the third round. Scores against another Premier League club here. They've released Kebe here down the right-hand side. Look at the pace. And he's pulled it back brilliantly. Oh, that's a lovely goal. You have to give them credit. What a well-worked counter-attacking goal. And Shane Long has his second of the afternoon. Milner into the penalty area. Bertrand got a foot to it. And he's only given possession straight back to Villa. Promising early on in the second half here. John Carew. Quayle with a shot. Ashley Young! And they've got one back. A vital goal for Aston Villa. Downing. Needs a telling cross. Oh, what a good cross it is. And there's the equalising goal. What a turnaround. It's John Carew. What a response. Urged on by the travelling support. Ashley Young now. Overlapping run from Stephen Warnock. More lovely football from Villa. Oh, and there's the third. Incredible. John Carew's second of the afternoon. And Aston Villa, in the space of 11 minutes at the start of this second half, have turned this game completely on its head. We're into added on time now. Only Carew in the middle. Downing on the edge of the area. Milner wasting away a few seconds, and now it's into John Carew. Oh, and that's a penalty. John Carew on a hat-trick. And Villa are going back to Wembley. Reading 2, Aston Villa 4.
Right, so what were your memories of that game? I just remember being deflated at half-time. This is one of those games where you're playing lower league opposition. Ladies and gentlemen, we used to be in the Premier League when this game took place. This is up there with the game, like the Tranmere Rovers game, where we were 3-1 down in the first leg. And you think Villa have just fucked up a great, great chance here of getting to the final or getting to Wembley. This is another, obviously, the prize of beating Reading would be to go to Wembley. And then the game that transpired after under Lambourc, where we were 3-1 down against Bradford after the first leg. And obviously the prize again was Wembley. And we came up short in the second leg. So half time, 2-0 down. I'm feeling the same way that Villa have blown a great opportunity to go to Wembley. And of course, we'd already been there and lost against United. So this was a chance to potentially make good on that. But cast your mind back, gentlemen. Can you distinctly remember being 2-0 down against Reading?
I can. I mean, you know, in years to come, it would transpire that Shane Long would always score against us. But yeah, in his time at Reading, he was quite a lively young striker. And I think it was our usual defensive howlers.
Look, when you look back at their game and you see what happened, and they could have been 3-0 up.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the time, Reading were a reasonable side, weren't they? They had a young Ryan Bertrand. They had, obviously, Shane Long, Gylfi Sigurdsson. They had some reasonably good players at that
point. Yeah, but we had Emil Heskey.
You look down the Villa side on the day. We did. We had Heskey and Carew leading the line that day.
Brad Friedel in goal.
The young Brad Friedel then, wasn't it?
Yeah, the
marginally younger, yeah.
I can see. Oh, dear.
This was like the staple Martin O'Neill team that we kind of remember.
Yeah, it was a strong side.
You've got the Downing, Young, Carew. I think Gabby came on, didn't he?
I think he did, yeah. And obviously Milner was playing as well. You had Stephen Warnock when he was in and amongst the England squad, Collins and...
Gabby kind of came on and helped turn the game, I think. Did he come at halftime? I can't remember exactly when he came on, but he's in all the highlights of the goals, so...
Yeah. I think, you know, we got the one goal back literally just after half time, and that kind of set the ball rolling.
It was quite an archetypal Ashley Young finish as well, one of those ones where he's sort of creeping in on the far post, and you almost think, oh, he's just going to stab it in, but he always had that nice way of, maybe he still does, I don't know, of lashing it high into the net. You know, those sort of shots that you don't see Villa play, you know, that confidence of absolutely knowing you're going to strike it into the roof of the net. That's my memory.
This is the problem with some of the Villa's best players, Ashley Young and Dwight York, for example. They end up going to United, and when they go to United, they're just deleted from all records and memories, fond memories. You just can't bring yourself to celebrate them. But Ashley Young was you know, fantastic for Villa, and a lot of the time carried this team, because sometimes it wasn't the halcyon days, certainly in terms of football under Martin O'Neill, we were very much built for the counter.
Do you know what I always think about, group of players is that Ashley Young, I do think, you know, it's like those players that went on, and like Gabby obviously stayed with us until his inverted commas retirement. Ashley Young was, you know, head and shoulders. And funny, watching back the Reading highlights, you know, I remembered the game and the score and roughly what happened. But you look at players like Downing was never going to become an Ashley Young, was he? He was...
Well, you look at the team. I mean, you look at the team starting lineup. There's only two players that went on to better themselves from that Martin O'Neill team. And that was Ashley Young and James Milner. Mm. The rest did not. Even, I suppose, James Collins went back to West Ham. But, you know, who the fuck are West Ham? Villa were top six, so none of those players apart from Milner and Young went on to better things. So that suggests what does that suggest?
Well, it says a couple of things to me that we massively overspent, and that you know how I feel about Martin O'Neill. You look at your Warnocks, you look at the fast wages spent on the Duns, and Carlos Coelho, a big
fee of this
big
world.
Fee as well. You know, no future proofing with the likes of Friedel. And actually looking at taking the Reading game, which we're talking about, is we had no natural replacement for a Carew. And Carew was one of those players who probably flattered to deceive to a degree at the top level at the best part of his career. But it was the kind of player that Villa could attract. And you look at the types of goals that he scored in the Reading game, and, you know, how couldn't we coax that more consistently out of a player like him?
Future proving. Mm-hmm. When you look at that Reading team and you look at the Villa team, from that point, if you were selling those players now, you'd make more money with the Reading starting 11, wouldn't you?
Well, remarkably
so. With the likes of Sigurdsson and Bertrand, yeah.
I mean, obviously not at the ages they are now, but if they're at the ages that they are, as we're, you
know. Yeah, I understand what you mean, yeah.
So, yeah, well, that was the last stand of Martin O'Neill. Obviously, a few months later, he was walking out days before the next season would kick off. And that was the frustrating thing, because he'd obviously done the dirty, but taking out the personality this is a Villa team that had got kind of close to what Brian Little had done, but he'd actually won a cup and got us to the semis, while Martin O'Neill had obviously, we were finalists in the League Cup this time round, got into the semi again, really. We were in that game against Chelsea for the first half hour, well, the first hour or so, until John Terry tried to cut James Milner in half. And then obviously the goals started to roll in. But you still thought we could kick on going.
It was that March month, wasn't it, where Villa's season just absolutely fell apart. And following that Reading game, I think we went to Chelsea and got absolutely torn to pieces, lost to them in the semi-final, and the whole season just sort of...
I mean, we finished 6 points off Spurs, who were in fourth place, and you looked at some of the points that we'd... I mean, we lost the last two games. I remember the last game of the season was against Blackburn, so there's 6 points straight away, and we were 6 points off, and we drew against Wolves and Stoke, and, you know, when we were supposedly at the height of our powers, we did drop some pretty poor points. And that was because I don't think we did have that expansive game. We really struggled at home to, you know, get anything more than a draw most of the time, because most of our success was away from home, because we were really built for the counter, solid in defence and pace to burn up front.
I mean, you look at that team and what the Villa team plays like now, and you look at a player like an Abraham, how he would have slotted in, or how like someone like a Jack Grealish would have slotted into that midfield, would have been really good at that time. Or even though we got Darren Bent the season later, Bent arrived maybe 6 months
too late.
Well,
that was the uncomfortable truth, though, Neil, though, was he never fancied a player like that. And I think even, you know, this is why Houllier ended up going out and buying a Bent, is because that you know, for £10 million more, by the way, was because that O'Neill fancied Harewood more in the moment, or Heskey more in the moment. And I don't know, when you actually look at the cumulative spend of O'Neill, it never made sense to me that he would go, well, do you know what, I'll be a bit more conservative here. It's almost like he wanted more players. He would sacrifice the fee over, and where we really were hamstrung then was wages, because we had so many players.
Habby Bay.
Shorey.
5 million for Marlon Howard.
Sidwell, Zat Knight. The list is endless.
Yeah, and I think the double deal when he did a Carew swap with Barros, and also got in Ashley Young, that was probably his best move that he ever made. And after pretty much every other transfer is there's question marks over it.
Mm. And of course letting one Gary Cahill leave as well.
But in terms of, everybody looks back to that period now, especially younger fans who were, let's say, were kids around that time, and they look at it as some kind of glory years of finished sixth 3 times on the trot. I remember being kind of as frustrated then as I am now, probably not as
I think it was an era where it really felt like we'd hit a glass ceiling, didn't it?
Yeah, and there was that, and it was that frustration where you knew Neil just didn't have it in him. When we played United at Wembley, you just knew that Ferguson was going to do him in the end. And that wasn't a great United team compared to ones that we'd actually beaten at Wembley, you know, in 94.
I was about to say that the thing, this is what separates truly great managers, is that, you know, there's been a standalone podcast on this, but he crops up over the many that we've done, is figures like Ron Atkinson, that they, in the moment, you know, he outthought Ferguson, you know.
Yeah.
And that's not to say he was a better manager overall, you know, there's no dispute that Ferguson was a fantastic manager, but on over 90 minutes, over, you know, tactically and man management, and this is the difference between, and this is why I think Villa never elevated themselves out of that top six thing, is that the uncomfortable truth was O'Neill had never set us up to be that, and as long as he was manager of Aston Villa Football Club, O'Neill was the biggest ego as well.
Yeah, my defining moment was we were ahead of Arsenal. And I think we had about 5 points on them. This is like around Christmas, January. O'Neill went out and bought Emil Heskey, and Wenger went out and got a Shavin. Mm. And I think a Shavin, did he score 5 goals?
Baby faced assassin.
No, that was Solskjaer.
Yeah, our Shavin was the other one.
Yeah, he had a baby face.
Well, that's going to annoy me.
He was a good player when he wanted to be, but it was that thing of with Villa, as on so many occasions in the modern history, of real opportunities missed just because of a lack of that real killer instinct to go, yeah, let's go the extra yard. Let's really go for broken.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, Ashavin scored more goals in one game than I think Heskey did that season. And yeah, no, it's you kind of look back at regret. But I mean, at least Martin O'Neill had Villa at the top table where we should be, challenging for Europe, getting into Europe, and also getting into cup finals and semi-finals. And while you know nobody's entitled to anything, that is where you should be pitching up and fighting and scrapping. Even if you come short, at least you're in the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's another depressing look at really how far the club has fallen.
Yeah,
you know, at that era, we didn't necessarily see the billions of Man City doing what they did, or you know, when Spurs really pushed on. But it just shows that with the right investment, where Villa should maybe. Definitely could have been.
Oh, would you swap today for those 666 years of Martin O'Neill?
No, nope. It doesn't matter because we're going to play him in a couple of weeks. So we can truly relive it all.
Yeah, we could just switch allegiances and go and support Nottingham Forest to relive those Martin O'Neill years.
A two-time European champion at proper club.
Proper club, proper history. And they play by the river, which just sounds cool.
Instead of under the lights, we could play by the river.
Play by the river.
Under the river.
On the quayside.
Back in the good old days, the away team, for example, my United supporting dad would tell me this story. When United were kind of known for their travelling fans, I think they would let the away fans out early at the City Ground. I think this is going back to the 70s. So United fans would make good use of that extra time of being let out early by preparing. They would all kind of line up by the Trent. And as the Forest fans come in, they would just throw them into the Trent.
Come on.
Yeah, so maybe we can do that. Wait for Martin O'Neill and throw him in the Trent as well. Elephant never forgets.
No.
Walking out on our club and leaving it to spiral into the despair that we have witnessed for the last 7 or so years. Right, I think it's time to head off until next time, where we will be able to talk about Dean Smith returning to Brentford. That is to be continued. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe if you're on Spotify or any of the podcast apps that you use. Become a patron as well. That would be fantastic. And until next time, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Keep the faith.
My old man said...
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.